just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, January 26, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
Analyzing the President's State of the Union address, California's new Citizens Redistricting Commission starts work, and the Los Angeles Poverty Department on their latest theater piece, plus this week's edition of The Right Hook.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. President Obama addressed Congress and the nation yesterday in his State of the Union address. Speaking for about an hour, he referred to this being our generation's Sputnik moment, announcing a relatively bold goal of adopting clean energy so that by 2035, 80% of America's electricity will come from clean energy sources. This went hand in hand with his call for cutting subsidies to oil companies. Obama also focused on education by first chastising parents and teachers for their responsibility and then lauding his own education policy called Race to the Top. He called it the most meaningful reform of our public schools in a generation. Obama called on Americans to, quote, out-innovate, out-educate, and out-build the rest of the world, even as he announced a five-year domestic spending freeze. The president also obliquely voiced support for the DREAM Act, extolled the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and then made a strong call for the return of military recruiters and ROTC onto all college campuses. He stood firm on the health care reform bill and preserving college tax credits. In job creation, the president called for major infrastructure rebuilding while assuring Congress that such a plan would not increase the deficit. In foreign policy, the president reiterated that the Afghanistan war was going well and sent a clear message of support for the Tunisian revolution. Using his standard rhetoric of trying to please both aisles of the party divide, the president made more than a dozen mentions of Democrats and Republicans working together. Well, joining me on the phone this morning to help analyze the president's State of the Union address is Amy Dean. She's a writer whose latest book is A New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. And Kai Wright, he is the editorial director of Color Lines and the Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute. Welcome to Uprising, Amy and Kai.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I want to first play an excerpt of President Obama's State of the Union address on the issue of clean energy and then get your response. This is a very bold goal that he announced.
Tonight, I challenge you to join me in setting a new goal. By 2035, 80% of America's electricity will come from clean energy sources. Some folks want wind and solar. Others want nuclear, clean coal, and natural gas. To meet this goal, we will need them all.
And that's President Obama announcing a bold new energy plan. By the way, for the interest of time, we have shortened the applause on many of the clips we'll be playing today. Amy Dean, what do you make of this new energy policy? Is this something new? Is it bold? Is it something that progressives should be heartened by?
You know, I think this president can rightly be acknowledged as the green president, and I think this is the first time we've had a president in this country be so bold about calling for a green economy, and not just an economy for some, but a green economy that creates jobs. I think two pieces that he referred to are important, and then let me quickly identify what he didn't say. Clearly, government has a role by incenting through tax policy industries to expand or create more jobs in these sectors. That he also called for an end of subsidies to the oil industry so that we can divert that kind of tax revenue to new industry or to jumpstart industry that doesn't exist yet. All things to the good. What the president didn't say, and what I hope to hear more from as we move forward, is where do the real resources come from to expand these sectors so that we are not just dependent on the current employers that are in the field or sector of creating alternative energy, but where is the infrastructure resources? Where is the National Infrastructure Bank to actually fund and seed a new and innovative industry?
He also didn't say anything about climate change and the fact that there's more and more evidence showing that things are worsening greatly.
You know, I think to his credit, he did set a goal with actual incentives for putting a million cars of electric cars on the road. I think the issue is that the presidency can only do so much. With respect to climate control, we are only one country in a much bigger equation.
We're also the most polluting country, and have among the highest per capita greenhouse gas emissions in the world.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to in any way take us off the hook, and it's a good point. I think that while there's more to be done, I feel that he put much on the table last night with respect to setting goals, creating resources to achieve them. And I think that when it comes to industries that pollute the most, I think we need a much more aggressive enforcement and a much greater penalty to create an incentive to follow the rules.
I want to bring Kai Wright into the conversation on the issue of education in particular. Kai, I want to play for you and our listeners the president's an excerpt of his speech yesterday on the issue of education.
Race to the Top is the most meaningful reform of our public schools in a generation. For less than 1% of what we spend on education each year, it has led over 40 states to raise their standards for teaching and learning. And these standards were developed, by the way, not by Washington, but by Republican and Democratic governors throughout the country. And Race to the Top should be the approach we follow this year as we replace No Child Left Behind with a law that's more flexible and focused on what's best for our kids.
President Obama speaking yesterday. Kai Wright, you are the editorial director of Colored Lines. You write for The Nation. And you have also written an article in Colored Lines saying the 2012 campaign begins now. What do you make of the president's lauding of his own Race to the Top initiative, which many have said is much worse than No Child Left Behind in terms of making a push to privatize education?
Yeah, I mean, so we'll be, and Collins will actually be digging into the administration's education policy and Race to the Top tomorrow in some detail. On the narrow issue of Race to the Top, you know, it is far more complicated than the president summed up last night. You know, there's a great deal of debate and controversy about how much of it is, in fact, top-down, how much of it is testing-driven, how much of it is teacher-bashing, how much of it is really just about empowering charter schools, you know, and how different it really is from No Child Left Behind, which is what it was supposed to be the counterpoint to. So I think, you know, I think there's a lot left to be discussed around Race to the Top, but most importantly, what the president wants is to bring it into the conversation, bring himself as an education reformer into the conversation this year. That is something that, if you'll recall, back in 2008, this was something he talked a lot about. He has not had an opportunity to really, in a public way, make his education efforts part of his profile over the last 2 years, and I think he's eager to bring that in. I think you see the same thing with the green economy stuff. He's eager to turn the corner and get us talking about some of the things that people liked about Obama in 2008, and out of a debate about the banks and the bailouts and the health care reform bill. But you know, I don't know how successful he's going to be in that, because the reality is that the banks and the economy remain the issue that matter most to folks' lives. I do just want to say a word on the green economy stuff. I'm less impressed with what he said last night, to be honest. They're all good sounding words, and again, it's all sort of the good sounding stuff he said 2 years ago around the green economy. But I found it, like much of the speech, pretty absent detail of how we're going to make this stuff happen. It's nice to say that he's going to end some of the big oil's tax breaks, but you know, we haven't seen this president fight for any kind of end to tax breaks so far, you know. He sort of dismissed this idea that there's a real and meaningful debate about whether clean coal, quote unquote, represents clean energy source or not.
And that's a good point, because some people say there's no such thing as clean coal. Well, I want to play another excerpt of the president's speech. I'll turn back to Amy in a moment on that. He talked about the Dream Act, but he didn't actually mention the words Dream Act. In his discussion of immigration, he used the terms undocumented and the term that many are calling for an end to, which is illegal. Let's take a listen to the president.
Today, there are hundreds of thousands of students excelling in our schools who are not American citizens. Some are the children of undocumented workers who had nothing to do with the actions of their parents. They grew up as Americans and pledge allegiance to our flag, and yet they live every day with the threat of deportation. Others come here from abroad to study in our colleges and universities, but as soon as they obtain advanced degrees, we send them back home to compete against us. It makes no sense. Now, I strongly believe that we should take on once and for all the issue of illegal immigration. And I am prepared to work with Republicans and Democrats to protect our borders, enforce our laws, and address the millions of undocumented workers who are now living in the shadows.
And that's President Obama's State of the Union address. Amy and Kai, it's amazing to listen to what the president just said. It sounded like a classic case of code switching. First, he talked about undocumented workers and the children of undocumented workers and how they live with the threat of deportation. And then all of a sudden, he wanted to strongly take on the issue of quote-unquote illegal immigration to work with Republicans and Democrats. The first half trying to, I think, pander to progressives, and the second part trying to pander to conservatives. Is that what came across to you as well? And do you think that kind of tactic is successful, is promising or successful? Amy, Dean first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think the overall template from yesterday's State of the Union speech was to, on the one hand, preempt Republicans on issues that they are leading the charge on. He was very clear about preempting them around earmarks and around the deficit and around tax cuts, and he did a brilliant job at preempting and taking away from them their issues. And as regards immigration, that's clearly what he did when he spoke about the question of competitiveness and referred to, on the one hand, illegal immigrants versus undocumented workers. The second thing that was formulaic about his speech, and again, you'll see it in the immigration clip that you just played, is that he, in addition to preempting Republicans, he also threw just enough to the base. So he intimated that while he didn't call for a Dream Act coming up, he intimated that immigration should come back up on this Congress. The bottom line, and that's, I think, overall what we can say about just about everything he said last night. It was a two-pronged strategy: preempt the Republican Party, entice, excite the base. Last thing I want to say is this: presidents set the tone. Presidents put forward a vision. But presidents, in and of themselves, cannot push change in any nation. And history demonstrates in this nation, as well as in nations across the world, that absent social movements and people being mobilized to push and expand for real public policy reforms, that a president can set the pace, he can create a vision, he can create a tone for national discussion, but we can't, you know, put on the president the objective that he will deliver in and of himself a fairer economy, a greener economy, and a more just economy.
Kai Wright, do you agree?
I agree with Amy's broader point that it's absolutely the case that, you know, our political system requires that there be a movement in order to make change.
But President Bush was far bolder in pushing a right wing agenda. I mean, he may not be the best model, but still, for the right wing, he certainly did wonders for their agenda in a way that Obama isn't doing for his base.
Well, so again, I want to be very careful that you cannot let the president off the hook, or anybody that's an elected official. In fact, the president is the president, as Condi Rice so memorably quoted for us back when George Bush was in office. And he does, in fact, have an enormous amount of power. So, for instance, you know, on the question of immigration, his administration has deported a record number of people annually since it's been in office, and it could stop that tomorrow, and it chooses not to do so. And you can talk about that on a number of different issues. The executive branch has an enormous amount of power to make change, and to do more than just say things. And so it is important that we hold the president accountable. But in holding the president accountable, that means we need to have movements outside of Washington in order to do that. And I do agree with Amy that is where change begins. I do want to say on the issue of immigration in his speech last night, you know, this is not a new formation for him. This is, or for the Democratic Party in general, this began in following welfare reform in the late 90s. This is their setup. They say, you know, we're going to own the enforcement conversation. We're going to be strong on enforcement, just as Amy pointed out. And then that is going to create space for a reform that tries to get, in their language, undocumented workers out of the shadows. Mm-hmm. So it's illegal immigration, undocumented workers, and that's the way they want to have the conversation. I think to your question about whether it works, plainly not. It's been 15 years or so worth of that formation, and we have militarized the border more, we have raised deportations to record levels, and we have no reform for workers and families and so forth. So it doesn't work, and I think what the DREAM Act represented this year was an effort to break from that. There was exactly the kind of outside of the Beltway movement that Amy's talking about that forced Washington's hand, on breaking that formation and saying, okay, well, look, let's vote on a reform that has nothing to do with enforcement. This is just about creating a pathway to citizenship for some immigrants here, and so we got that vote. It passed the House, failed the Senate, but it'll be back. And I think that's mm-hmm. important.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Kai Wright. He is the editorial director of Color Lines and an Alfred Nobler Fellow of the Nation Institute. He wrote the piece in Color Lines this week called "The State of Our Union is Weak, but the 2012 Campaign Begins Now." Also, Amy Dean, co-author of A New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. She wrote an article in These Times magazine called "Mr. President, the Fight for the Middle Class Isn't in Washington." Amy, I want to play for you and Kai a couple of more clips from the President's State of the Union, one on the issue of free trade, which I know you will have a lot to say about. He lauded the free trade agreement with South Korea, and then on the fact that he's calling for a spending freeze here domestically. Here is the President again.
And last month, we finalized a trade agreement with South Korea that will support at least 70,000 American jobs. This agreement has unprecedented support from business and labor, Democrats and Republicans. And I ask this Congress to pass it as soon as possible. Tonight, I am proposing that starting this year, we freeze annual domestic spending for the next 5 years. Now, this would reduce the deficit by more than $400 billion over the next decade and will bring discretionary spending to the lowest share of our economy since Dwight Eisenhower was president.
Amy Dean, President Obama is talking about and praising a free trade deal, even as the NAFTA, the preeminent free trade deal the U.S. has entered into with Mexico and Canada, has shown failures. And he's also calling for a spending freeze, which seems to be exactly what the Republicans were hoping for. What do you make of this and how it will figure into any kind of prospect for improving our economy?
I'm not sure what part of the labor movement supported the South Korea trade agreement to which he referred last
night.
Not the part of the labor movement that I'm a part of or anyone that I know of. The issue of trade, the Democrats have been much more of the enemy on this issue than have the Republicans. We expanded and integrated ourselves into the world economy unprecedentedly under the Clinton administration, more so than any Republican administration, and changed the entire rules of world trade under Bill Clinton. And when Bill Clinton campaigned in 1990 to be the president that would only move forward on global trade so long as we had similar rules and rights for people in the environment as we did for compact discs and software protection, and abandoned us 18 months into his administration with the entire Democratic Party. Unfortunately, the debate around trade in this country has been sort of hijacked by should we or should we not trade. I think at this point, no Democrat, no one in the labor movement would disagree that America must integrate itself into the world economy. The question is how best to trade. And we've yet to have a president, or for that matter, Democratic leadership, stand up and say, we have to assert that there are certain values that we hold near and dear to our hearts as a country, and that they ought to be a condition of trade with any country around the world. That's not to say that we're calling for some international wage that would hurt the Southern Hemisphere, but that is to say that if we believe collective bargaining is an important value here in America, we should extend that right to any nation we trade with around the world. And if we're not prepared to do that, and we're not prepared to engage in that kind of trade, then we really are only creating trade agreements that benefit capital, continue to allow capital to roam the globe freely, but not to do anything to create an upward harmonization of wage standards for workers around the world.
Kai Wright, what do you make of the fact that President Obama is calling for this spending freeze that he says would reduce the deficit by more than $400 billion over the next decade, and that it will require painful cuts at the same time when the economy is in such bad shape? It seems as though Americans are constantly carrying more than their fair share of the tax burden. Corporations get tax breaks, Americans get taxed, and they also don't get any spending on them.
I mean, like many things with the spending versus deficit reduction conversation, it sounds good and it's meaningless. He's talking about freezing discretionary domestic spending. That does nothing to address where the real money is spent. You know, the real money is in Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and defense spending, things that aren't, in fact, discretionary. So, it's actually a nice piece of politics for him, as Amy was talking about earlier, to be able to sort of steal the Republicans' thunder on I'm a responsible spender. So he pairs that. He pairs this idea of a spending freeze with the word innovation. So it's steal their thunder on I'm being responsible, and then pivot to what we have to be doing is investing and innovating. That's where we do our spending. And I think that's the conversation that the president wants to have over the next 2 years. It's one he actually is pretty good at and was good at in 2008.
But what investing and innovating means what, right? I mean, investing in education, right?
That's the problem, is that when the rubber meets the road, given where we're at, we need massive and very tangible investment, indeed, in creating jobs, and an investment led by the federal government.
And also with state governments hurting so deeply with cuts in the higher education, which is where innovation can start and often does start. He said very little about states like California and the higher education cuts.
States will need emergency appropriations from the federal government. We'll need a whole swath of things. You've noticed remarkably absent from this speech and absent from anything the White House has had to say in the last several months is the word stimulus, right? That's gone. Mm-hmm. Stimulus is replaced with innovation, but the concept is the same. They're just being more vague about it. And the reality is that we are unlikely in the next 2 years to get any of the kind of actual call it stimulus, call it innovation, call it intervention, call it spending. We're unlikely to cut a check for any of these things in the next 2 years, and that spells trouble.
Well, Kai Wright, Amy Dean, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today. Plenty more to talk about. We didn't get to foreign policy, but we'll certainly be covering what's happening in Afghanistan, Tunisia, Egypt, which the president didn't even mention, in the next few days. Thanks so much, Kai Wright. Amy Dean, thanks so much
thank
for joining
you.
Us.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Kai Wright is the editorial director of Color Lines magazine. He's also an Alfred Nobler Fellow of the Nation Institute. Amy Dean, co-author of A New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. And we'll link to both the articles that my guests have written on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. This is Uprising. After this week's edition of The Right Hook, we will find out about the latest performance of the LAPD. I'm talking about the Los Angeles Poverty Department. And we'll also hear about California's new Citizens Redistricting Commission starting its work. What's in store for them between now and August?
Welcome to The Right Hook, a weekly segment which covers the machinations of the right wing, from the Republican Party to the Tea Party Patriots and beyond. I'm Chris Bennett. Glenn Beck has again managed to incite death threats from his followers. This time, the death threats are for City University of New York professor Francis Fox Piven. For over a year, Beck has targeted Piven as the foil in his paranoid conspiracy theories. Beck has put Piven and her late husband, Richard Cloward, at the center of a powerful left-wing movement to collapse the U.S. economy. The grist for Beck's paranoia and his justification for violence towards Piven is an article Piven and Cloward wrote for The Nation 45 years ago. Beck calls Piven, quote, an enemy of the Constitution and includes her in his rogues gallery of liberals out to destroy America. According to Media Matters, Beck's regular vilification of Piven has now resulted in a number of death threats towards her. Readers of Beck's website, The Blaze, have posted comments aimed at Piven such as, quote, one shot, one kill, and asked, quote, why is this woman still alive? Whether Beck's aim is to scare progressives into silence or really to have them executed by the fringe rabble who follow him is unclear and does not matter. For all his ridiculous ranting, Beck is really talking to that special someone in his audience, that one person willing to complete the act, pull the trigger, or detonate the bomb. And this festering economic crisis is also a crisis for America's once-vaunted public universities. Daniel Denver, writing for Alternet, reports that state aid to universities is being cut and federal stimulus funds are drying up. Universities have responded by raising tuition, capping enrollments, and cutting full-time positions to rely on cheaper, part-time faculty. In Arizona, for example, state universities have raised their tuitions up to 20% to make up for cuts. And the Tea Party-infused, austerity-minded Republicans now have 29 governorships and at least 720 new state legislature seats nationwide. In Ohio, Governor John Kasich is expected to make deep cuts to universities. Educators are nervous, for good reason. Kasich once supported abolishing the Department of Education during his tenure as chairman of the House Budget Committee. But from 2001 to 2009, Kasich had no problem getting paid $50,000 per year by Ohio State University to deliver just a few lectures per month. For Uprising, I'm Chris Bennett, and this is The Right Hook, reality-based news and views.
Thanks, Chris. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. California's Citizens Redistricting Committee will soon begin the complex task of redrawing boundaries for the State Board of Equalization, state legislative and congressional districts. Redistricting follows any census year when population shifts are recorded and voting areas are redrawn to reflect changes. Traditionally, redistricting is done by elected officials, who are notorious for gerrymandering, which is a practice of intentionally creating districts to benefit one political party or group and disempower the political opposition. The practice is blamed for creating a stagnant political environment in which incumbents are unresponsive to their constituents because they're certain their party will retain power year after year. In 2008, Proposition 11 was passed by California voters, establishing that district lines for state legislative districts would be drawn by a 14-member citizens committee. In November, voters gave that committee even more power by approving Proposition 20, requiring it to also redraw district boundaries for congressional seats. Hundreds of California residents applied to be on the committee. Over the past 2 years, the candidates were slowly vetted and whittled down until 14 members were appointed. The group does not have much time to complete its task. It has a deadline of August 15th of this year. Part of the new redistricting process is for the committee to take input from the public on how to draw the lines so that communities of interest, as they're called, are kept together. A diverse array of community advocacy groups have been following the process from the committee's inception, and they are beginning an outreach campaign now to educate the public on its role. My guest is Chris Carson. She's the redistricting program director at the League of Women Voters, California. Welcome to Uprising, Chris.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first of all, what was the process of vetting these committee members? As I mentioned, hundreds of people applied to be on the committee. How did the committee arrive at the members that it has now?
Well, actually, the initial application, there were over 30,000 Californians
Wow.
who applied. It was winnowed down. The people who got through the initial screening for the basic conflict of interest and some other tests had to submit an additional application answering seven questions and giving background, letters of recommendation. The Bureau of State Audit, which is in charge of the selection process, had appointed a panel of three auditors, one Democrat, one Republican, and one who was of neither party, and with staff. And they went through a very, very thorough screening of the applicants. It was all done in public. They did quite a lot of background checks. They didn't take applicants' word for anything. They got it down to 120 applicants, and they were all brought to Sacramento, and they were interviewed for an hour. That was all public. You could watch it. And then from that 120, they winnered that down to 60, 20 Democrats, 20 Republicans, and 20 that belonged to neither party. And those names went to the legislature, and the legislative leadership had the option of striking up to 24, equal number from each pool. And then after they did their strikes, there was a random drawing by the state auditor to pick the first eight, three Democrats, three Republicans, and two of neither party. And then the eight picked the six to make up what the commission lacked in diversity and of both race, ethnicity, gender, skills, geographic region, that type of thing. Now we have the 14. One has resigned, and the commissioners will pick a replacement beginning this week. But that's how they got there.
So that sounds like a pretty lengthy process, but also sounds pretty fair. Is the League of Women Voters approving of this process?
Oh, yes. We were very impressed. I think everyone was very impressed with the thoroughness and the balance and the fairness of the applicant review panel that the Bureau of State Audit put together. We feel they did a very good job.
Now, it's amazing because, most people don't think about redistricting and where district lines are drawn except when it's right before an election or a major election, at least. This is a good time, however, between elections to think about these things. One of the issues that I mentioned was the committee taking input from the public on how to draw the district lines in order to keep communities of interest together. What does communities of interest mean?
Well, communities of interest is a term of art. It means there are various definitions, but basically it means groups of people who live together in a central geographic area, who have common social and economic interests, racial, ethnic, linguistic interests in common, perhaps environmental interests in common. They live along the same transportation route. Interests in common. In urban areas, you usually will find neighborhoods that define. They say we're community of interest for these reasons. In a rural area, it's a little bit broader. But just basic people who are of the same type and sort, and who have a common interest.
Now, this committee, as it is currently formed, how long does it basically last? I mean, do they draw lines between now and August and then get disbanded, or is it a committee that stays on for a while?
Well, the final maps will be done, approved out there August 15th. The committee does not officially disband then, because there might be lawsuits. The committee also has the task of, if they want to make recommendations for change in some of the process to the legislature. So, no, the committee does not disband officially when the maps are drawn. They are de facto there, well, probably, for 10 years until the next committee commission is put together. But they'll be there for a while with some tasks.
Now, how will the public then be able to give input? I suppose, where a public participation becomes extremely important in order to have the kind of representation that that communities and neighborhoods want.
Yes, the commission is very, very much aware of the need to start getting public input. You see, California will get the census data late March. The deadline will be April 1st, but at that point we will have, the numbers for the state. But the committee has the task of getting public input about the types of districts they want before they start drawing maps. So the commission will be out around the state. They're talking about maybe as many as 50 meetings around the state where the public will come and talk to them about their neighborhoods, their communities, why they want to be kept together. And the commission it will be in Claremont, California, starting in early February, and as part of it, like a little trial project, on the first Saturday they'll be there, they're going to have a session where the public can come and give input about their community, just so the commission can decide what would be the best form, how they would like the public to give them testimony. This won't, in a sense, really count. They'll come back and get more testimony. But the commission wants to get started on this, so people need to be aware that they have to be thinking about it now, because the commission will be going around the state in February and March and early April to get as much public input as they can, so that when they start to draw the maps, they already know what people want and don't want.
My guest is Chris Carson. She's a redistricting program director at the League of Women Voters California. We're talking about the work of the newly formed redistricting committee that Californians essentially empowered through two propositions. Now, Chris, what advice can you then give local organizations for our listeners who might be part of local organizations that are interested in electoral politics, which certainly does impact all of us, particularly on a local level?
Well, you mean if they want to get involved in terms of how they would like to speak to the commission, what should they do? The League of Women Voters and a number of organizations have formed a redistricting collaborative, which is designed to help communities organize, to talk to them about how to define themselves, how to print out, Google Maps and draw your community lines. And so I would say that, if you're interested, you contact the League or one of the other organizations. I'm going to give you a website. It's redistrictingca, that's all one word, in a sense, redistrictingcalifornia.org. You'll find there, all of the organizations. Could contact them. You can contact the League of Women Voters at www.lwvc.org, and we could try to help you or find another community group in your area who could come and teach the community what they need to know in order to speak to the commission.
Well, finally, Chris, are you confident that this method of drawing district lines is going to undermine much of the gerrymandering that happens in California, and really, of course, it happens in other states, but here in California, could this committee make this whole process fairer so that politicians can be held better accountable?
Yes, we believe so, because, of course, you see, the commissioners aren't drawing their own lines. They've been very thoroughly vetted for conflicts of interest, not only for themselves but their families. So they have no interest they are committed to drawing lines that keep communities together allow the voters to define, where they what kind of districts they want, rather than cutting them up and for what the politician wants.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. So those websites, again, are redistrictingca.org
right.
and lwvc.org.
Right.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Carson is the redistricting program director at the League of Women Voters California, and we'll post the websites that she mentioned on our website, uprisingradio.org. We'll also send those out to our Daily Digest email list, which you can sign up for through the website. We always put any websites, event information, and other things that we mention on the air on that email list, so you can get it directly in your inbox every day. This is Uprising. After this short break, we'll find out about the LAPD's latest theater piece. I'm talking about the Los Angeles Poverty Department. They're performing a piece called State of Incarceration at the Highways Performance Space this weekend. Stay tuned.
Need to earn a couple extra college credits? Why not earn them at KPFK? If you appreciate progressive news, culture, music, and more, come and be a part of the movement. Call 818-985-2711, extension 513, to learn about internship opportunities. Or log on to kpfk.org and click on Volunteer to find out more.
Hello, my dear KPFK listener. This is Brother Cornell West.
And I'm Tavis Smiley. Join us each week on our new program, Smiley and West.
It's Gary Sinek.
The heart golden. Brother West is what I wanted to talk about.
I don't think the gods have much to do with it. If anything, the god of imperialism, the god of colonialism, all of that.
Smiley and West, Saturdays at 11 a.m. here at KPFK Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm Arundhati Roy, and you're listening to Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. According to a 2010 report by the Pew Center on the states, California has the second highest prison population in the nation after Texas. The Golden State dropped to number two after leading the nation in inmate population in prior years. However, prison overcrowding remains a serious and largely unmitigated issue. California's correctional facilities are billed to house 80,000 inmates, but they hold between 144,000 and 156,000 people. A legal battle to end overcrowding has been waged in California courts, and after a three-judge panel in 2009 ordered 40,000 inmates released, the state appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court heard arguments in the case, and in early December 2010, but has not yet issued a ruling. While the constitutional rights of California's incarcerated are debated in court, their daily existence is laid bare for audiences who attend this weekend's performance of State of Incarceration by the Los Angeles Poverty Department at Highways Performance Space. The LA Poverty Department, or LAPD for short, is a nonprofit organization that seeks to expose the causes and effects of poverty through art. State of Incarceration will immerse audiences in the prison environment by replicating those spaces, filling the performance area with 60 bunk beds. The performance was created with collaboration from formerly incarcerated adults. My guests are John Malpede. He's the founder of the Los Angeles Poverty Department, and artist and activist Ricardo Porter, who is an LAPD performer and a contributing writer on this weekend's piece. Welcome to Uprising.
Hi, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So let's talk about the specific piece itself before we go into the LAPD. How do you go about putting the audience in a live theater piece, giving them a sense that this is what prison feels like? Ricardo?
Well, give them the bare facts. John calls it the real deal. We don't sugarcoat anything. We take stories from people's actual experiences, and we take statistics from such as papers like what you're reading there, and we get the information and we share it with the performers, who are, most of them are Skid Row residents. So they've been in and out and around the system for so long, it's familiar information to them. And then people like myself who have been behind bars, I actually know what I applied a lot of the things that I actually saw myself there, because I was in the self-help community in prison. So I took the positive route in there, and I utilized that to help a lot of people there and myself, of course, to avoid that type of behavior in the future. I took it and flipped it to a positive, but I didn't forget, like some people do, well, I'm doing good now, I don't have to talk about that. I think it's something that's important to share that other people don't have to go through it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what I infused into this performance.
John?
As you mentioned, I think we're filling the whole space with prison bunk beds, because in the overcrowded state prisons, what's happened is all the common areas, the dormitories, the former gymnasiums, I mean, and the cafeterias have become dormitories with two and triple tiered bunk beds filling the entire place. So basically, that's what our performance space looks like. If you come to the performance.
So that's the setting of it, and then the audience is squeezed in with the performance.
Exactly. So they could really. So the audience plays an active role in contributing to creating the overcrowded feel.
Yeah, they become part of the scene because they're in the bunks with us. They're laying all around with us in the beds. So
how do you infuse the statistics of reality into the theater piece, into stories?
Yeah, in this case, actually, what we're doing is we have a gallery exhibition along with it, and in that gallery exhibition, we have images charting the rise of number of incarcerated people in California at the same time as the prison construction schedule over the last 30 years, and map that against the lawsuit you mentioned, which has been going on for 21 plus years. So during the time that originally inmates sued about the conditions inside the jails, there's only been more incarceration, more new prisons built, and more overcrowding. So the case is now in the Supreme Court, like you said, and actually we've been in contact with one of the lawyers in that case, so an interview with him is also going to be in the gallery, and we've been getting that 184 page court decision you mentioned. We've been getting 184 Californians as we've built the piece to read a page of that decision. So we're both going to be projecting some of that in the gallery and also continuing, because we haven't gotten to page 184 yet.
So just to remind listeners, we're talking about a performance piece that's happening this weekend. It's called State of Incarceration, put on by the Los Angeles Poverty Department, Friday and Saturday, January 28th and 29th, and Friday and Saturday, February 4th and 5th. All performances are at 8:30 p.m. By the way, the Friday, the 28th performance is already sold out. And it's happening at Highways Performance Space, 1651 18th Street at Olympic Boulevard in Santa Monica. You can find out more at highwaysperformancespace.org or by calling 310-315-1459, 310-315-1459. Is there a way for the two of you to share a little piece of this performance for our listeners via radio?
Sure. Why not? That would be great, wouldn't it?
Carlo?
I was working in the laundry, and I got a note from the women's side saying, "Send me a man's shirt. I want to feel what it's like. I want to feel how a man feels in his shirt." I sent her the shirt. Then I fantasized that it got to her. How that felt. And then that was like a little scene where I'm working in laundry, and what happens is people send little notes and then they ask for men's shirts, and they give you their contact, and then you write them a letter.
So these are connections between the inside and the outside.
Yeah, it's the way the men and the women connect in jail, because we're not together. So they send it through their laundry.
Well, Ricardo, tell us then, I mean, for people who've never been behind bars, or, you know, have only had short experiences behind bars, what you're describing sounds like prisoners trying to keep some semblance of their humanity in a space that is utterly dehumanizing.
Yeah. And with that, I'll go to another character quickly. This one is called Angelic Prisoner, and to describe what you're talking about, the angelic prisoner is the guy who looks out for the prisoners that aren't strong. And in the piece, he's kind of like giving a statement throughout the piece about feeding people who are hungry, because he's saying we're not just feeding them physically, we're feeding their humanity, we're feeding their lust for life, their desire to come up out of their rummage, you know, their fallenness. And so in this piece, it reflects on, like, there was an incident where this guy, he wanted to be in a liked by a gang, and that gang, he wasn't from their part of the country. I mean, their part of, he was from the north, and these guys were from the south. And he was trying to win favor with the guys in the south, and he ends up getting beat up by the guys in the north, and then he has to be protected. But none of the gangs protect him. I'm the guy who saves him by getting him moved, because I go to the lieutenants and I tell them he's in danger.
So that's the best way to get him out.
Mm-hmm. And he does this kind of thing. So just a little bit from him, he goes like this: you're cleaning one wall at a time, one floor at a time, one crack in the floor, one cell at a time, one prison at a time, one liquor store at a time, one pool hall at a time, one porn shop at a time, one billboard, one piece of graffiti, one piss at a time, one city. And that's like a little piece to that, because it's real, it's lengthier, but it's like he's talking about cleaning up from the inside out. He's in a cell, locked down for 9 years, 10 years, how many years? They etch on the wall. That's like the visualization of what might happen, of how many days, how many months they're there. Because there's no calendars. The cops come in, they tear everything down. You're not supposed to have anything on the wall. So they etch things in. And, you know, it's pretty intense stuff.
My guests are Ricardo Porter, who is a performer with the Los Angeles Poverty Department. He's also a contributing writer to the piece called State of Incarceration that he's been sharing with us. It's going to be performed at the Highways Performance Space starting this week. And also John Malpede, founder of the LAPD, is in studio with me. John, give our listeners a sense of how the LAPD was first formed. How did you put this theater piece, I mean, this group of artists together? You know, these aren't just artists who are trying to depict a certain reality that they've never experienced. These are artists who are depicting, in many ways, their own lives and their own realities.
I want to say that, and then I want to go back to something because you really hit the nail on the head earlier. But you know, Skid Row. I started LAPD when I was just helping out activists in Skid Row who were trying to get better conditions for people living there 25 years ago. But my background was as a performance artist, so I started doing these workshops, people wanted to talk about things that they were concerned about and to get them out into the world. So we've been doing that around issues affecting Skid Row and people living in poverty in other spots. But in 33% of the parolees coming to Los Angeles out of the state prisons end up in the Skid Row area. So, you know, and beyond that, the aggressive policing that goes on there, Ricardo referred to this earlier, you know, most of the jaywalking tickets that get written in the city of Los Angeles happen in Skid Row. Then people who don't pay the $100 plus tickets, they end up going to county jail. So, everybody... you know, for a long period of time or short periods of times, knows plenty about. They have lived expertise, is the way we look at it. You know, that's been the strength of the group from the beginning, and in this piece, because it's impacted so many people in Skid Row, there was a huge interest in participating in this piece, and lots of people, and we have a huge cast, plus there are a lot of other people that came through and contributed who aren't even in the cast. What you said earlier about keeping yourself intact in this dehumanizing situation, that's really the through line of the piece. it's not particularly character based, but it's sort of a you know, a communal quest where people have added their wisdom, going from, you know, how do you survive on the coming in and how do you survive coming out. And we've in doing it, we've also worked with people who participated who are in some good reentry programs downtown and in South Central, and we performed at a couple, one in Van Nuys and in downtown, and you know, those programs and the people in them are all about, you know, figuring about, you know, keeping their spiritual side intact, you know, advancing as people, and also about creating better conditions for everybody in the society. So those programs are also in jeopardy right now, you know, given with all the talk about budget.
Well, let me
cutting.
Remind our listeners again, the piece is called State of Incarceration. It's happening at the Highways Performance Space this Friday and Saturday, next Friday and Saturday. All performances are at 8:30 p.m. And the Highways Performance Space is located at 1651 18th Street in Santa Monica. Highwaysperformancespace.org is the website. 310-315-1459 is the phone number. Does LAPD have its own website?
We do. LAPoverty.org.
There you go.
LAPoverty.dept.org.
Yeah, and it's extensive. We got a lot of stuff up there.
Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today. John Malpied, founder of the Los Angeles Poverty Department, Ricardo Porter, LAPD performer and contributing writer on the piece. Thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck
to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you for having us.
And again, the website is LAPoverty.dept.org. You can also find out more at HighwaysPerformanceSpace.org. For free tickets to this weekend's performance, we have one pair for Friday, one pair for Saturday. Call us at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. For Sonali's Subversive Thought for the Day, Angela Davis once said, jails and prisons are designed to break human beings, to convert the population into specimens in a zoo, obedient to our keepers, but dangerous to each other. That's Angela Davis. That's Sonali's Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Ty Swanger is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can find links and other information that we mentioned on the air. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8. I tiptoe.